Welcome back, guys. DGS on KMOX. A few minutes past 2 p.m. I'm sure you've heard by now, but Whitey Herzog has passed away. Friend of the show and great sports writer, baseball guy, Derek Gould, joined us now. Derek, it's always great to have you on the show. Thanks for taking a few minutes out for us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So I'll ask the first question. I'll turn it over to your buddy, Kevin Wheeler. So we all know Whitey from the gigantic personality and all the Whiteyisms, but I think sometimes the baseball acumen gets swallowed up in all of that personality. Let's, if you would, talk to us about Whitey Herzog, the baseball mind.
Oh, goodness. I mean, who better to ask than, like, not baseball writer, but his peers. I mean, they had headaches going up against him as a strategist. And, you know, whether it was his contemporaries or the managers who followed in his footsteps with the game that he kind of helped create or the style of play that he certainly popularized, you know, they all spoke about how just his keen sense and feel for the game. And that went for offensively, obviously, with Whitey Ball and everything, but also just like a kind of a sixth sense about when to make a pitching change and how to manage a bullpen. And, you know, he would offer insight to managers Tony La Russa, Mike Schilt, Oliver Marmol. He's talked baseball with them all. And, you know, and that's just the Cardinals managers, but you also think about the other managers as well. And they walk away from those conversations almost to a person saying, man, that's just like some of the biggest baseball intellect I've encountered. I mean, he has, you know, a guy stands out for what he's able to do as a manager, what buttons he's able to push, what edges he's able to find in the game when you have people who have the same position walk away and go, man, I hadn't thought about that. Or, man, he would have got me in that. Or, man, what a great baseball IQ.
You know, and it's also interesting, Derek, in that, you know, today when we look at how teams are built, and really since the book Moneyball, we've really talked a lot about how teams look for things that can be exploited, things they can take advantage of. But Whitey Ball preceded that. He looked at his home stadiums. He looked at the circumstances, the surface, the AstroTurf. He's like, this is what we need to do. We can win if we have a lot of speed and we cover a lot of ground and we can catch everything and we can pitch. And building a team with a very specific strategy of others aren't doing this. Players were, but teams weren't. You know, Ricky Henderson was Ricky Henderson, but teams weren't doing that. I find that to be almost a precursor of what followed.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of it comes with the timing of it too, right? More games on television.
Yeah.
Turf being part of it. I've been going through the archives actually today, working on a few stories, but also kind of reading up on some things or revisiting some stories, and, you know, saw a conversation that Whitey Herzog had with my colleague, the late Rick Hummel, about how he goes, some of the things I was doing, the Gas House Gang was doing, some of the things I was doing, you know, you think back to the Dodgers of the time doing, but the Cardinals just did it to an extreme and did it better. And in a way, you're right. I mean, you're exactly right as far as like finding that Moneyball market inefficiency, which
right.
is what the game, that ballpark, that book is all about, is like, okay, look, the power was being paid at that point in time. And there was Whitey Herzog who said, well, as a team, we're really going to try to surpass Roger Maris's home run record, right?
Yeah, as a team,
they weren't going to hit a whole bunch. Yeah, as a team. They weren't going to go out there and hit that many home runs. So they had to find a way to generate runs, and speed was a way to do it, but so was, and here's to your you know, to add to your point, here's run prevention.
Yep.
And
yep.
So he was doing kind of 85 Bears stuff in baseball before you really got to thinking about like the money ball aspect of run prevention. And he was doing that with great pitching. He was doing that with the aforementioned savvy bullpen moves, and he was doing it with defense. He was blitzing other teams.
Mm-hmm. And for those that, I mean, I think people who go back to that time remember what artificial surface, what AstroTurf was compared to what an artificial surface is now.
Oh.
Now it's a little bit faster than grass, but it's not like it was back then. Back then, it was like bouncing a Super Bowl on concrete. That's how the ball bounced on the AstroTurf, and it would get super hot. And like, a hard ground ball had a decent chance of making it to the wall if you couldn't cut it off.
Derek, did teams hate playing at Busch Stadium back during that era?
I mean, how long do you think I've been covering the Cardinals, man?
Well, you know, it's funny. I feel a connection to this because where I went to college, they kind of took, they copied that essentially.
Interesting.
Like our head coach is a guy named Ron Frazier, Hall of Famer in his own right, but we played Whitey
Name
ball.
Dropper.
Yeah, we played Whitey ball. We had the same turf, that same surface, and we just had fast guys everywhere and pitching. And it was because you could take advantage of your home field.
Yeah, my time at Busch Stadium when they had that turf is limited. To the first couple of years I was in college at Mizzou and would come and watch the games. One of the first baseball stories I wrote involving the Cardinals was actually them going away from the turf. As I pitched that story to the newspaper there in Columbia to come to St. Louis to do. You could see it in, I could see it as a baseball fan and read about it in the Post-Dispatch or out in Colorado and we'd get some of the stories reprinted because of all the Cardinal fans out there along the front range. And, you would talk, I don't know if the place frustrated opponents as much as the team did, if you could hit the ball out, you could still be a home run hitter. And, but there was very limited other ways to win in St. Louis. And when the Cardinals were at their best in the 80s, obviously, in the 90s, it was a different time and the talent wasn't there. And, they went back into kind of the cold snap that then, Tony La Russa brought them out of in the same way Herzog did, bringing them back out of the 70s. But there in the 80s, it was a very kinetic style of baseball to play against. You can liken it to another sport in it was fast break, full court press basketball. So playing the Cardinals
like
was
the
exhausting.
Lake Show.
You know what I remember about him, Derek? I got to spend a couple of hours one time just one-on-one with Whitey, and he was telling me stories that seemed like they should be secret, but he he probably had told three other people that morning, right? Because it was Whitey. But he was not only managing baseball players, he was managing huge personalities with some huge problems, and that was part of what he was telling me about. He's like, oh, man, we had to have, a beer keg in the back just so to keep him from this or that. Like, he was not only managing when to bring in the relief pitcher, but just how to keep these guys on the field.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of managing, right? I mean, your first question was about strategy, but, on the field is only part of it. And there are some managers who are hired for how they run a clubhouse, how they connect and relate to players. In fact, you probably see more of that as front offices and analytics departments are with some teams very much involved in the inning to inning, pitch to pitch strategy. That obviously wasn't the case in the 80s, but managing clubhouse was definitely in it. And you think back to when Whitey resigned in 1990, right? July 1990, one of the things he talked about was being able to get the players to play and his feeling and how the clubhouse was responding to him. I know Bernie Miklas at the Post-Dispatch wrote several columns at that time about how Whitey was trying to connect with the players and not having much success. Years later, Tony La Russa, 20 years later, Tony La Russa would talk about that same thing about that messaging to the clubhouse. I mean, you can do all the strategy and make all the moves and everything like that. But Tony La Russa, who spent a lot of time talking to Whitey Herzog as well, was like, if that message falls flat and all of a sudden those ears in the clubhouse start turning away from you, then you know that it's probably time to move on. And Whitey mentioned that when he made that sudden, unexpected move, really dramatic move to resign with 2.5 years remaining on his contract.
Derek, so let's go to your experience here. You've been covering the Cardinals for a long time. Obviously, one of the great things about the organization is guys like Whitey are around, and they're around a lot. So just if you have an interaction or maybe the first time you had an extended interaction with him, what stands out to you from your time talking to him directly?
Yeah, on a small scale, on a small personal scale, I remember when he first called me by name, that was kind of cool. That meant that, I'd been around long enough, or maybe I wrote something that caught his eye, or probably just Hummel had a minute and a half earlier told him my name, now that I think back on it. So maybe I should have thought this answer through. Most of my time with talking to Whitey was, either was about Rick Hummel or with Rick Hummel.
Right.
Because I enjoyed those stories so much, and we would just talk about how the interaction between the press and the manager had changed so much, and whether it changed for the better or whether it changed for the worse, and the stories of you know, Whitey holding the plane at times. You know, riders used to fly on the plane at times with the team. That does not exist, has not existed in my time, on really, to be honest, but definitely not on the baseball beat. And, you know, if Rick was up against a tough deadline, all of a sudden there might be a door that wouldn't quite close on the plane and they'd have to wait a little bit, and then Rick would show up and magically be fixed and off they go. you know, stuff like that. But to be honest, like another times that I was around Whitey, again, it'll often involve Rick. But also there were times when it was Tony La Russa, Whitey Herzog, and Rick, and gosh, wow. You just sit back and you just learn baseball. I think I'm forever grateful because I have such a fondness for this game, and that's really what made me want to try to be a baseball writer, but also made me think that baseball writing was not going to ever be possible. But I'm forever grateful for the fact that, like, I learned so much from listening to Tony La Russa and Rick Hummel, and then at times, especially in spring, Whitey Herzog talk about the game and what they looked for. And then early days, George Kissel around at times too. I mean, it was like graduate level baseball. It was seminar level baseball. And I knew just to sit quietly, nod if they brought me into the conversation, saying, you know, I think it's more important to know what you would have done in that spot, and then take notes later so I could study up and do better next time.
Very cool, Derek Gould. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. And as always, thanks.
Yeah, you bet. Have a great day, guys.
See you, bud.
You know whose name we're not saying is Red Shandy's.
Wow, yeah, I mean,
they spent so much time together.
Yeah, they did, and I mean, you talk about knowledge. That experience that Derek describes when you're just there and they're talking, you could not pay to beat that.
Andrew, you have quite a cornucopia of ideas here. Mm-hmm. To Jake from State Farm, weird you out.
Yeah, so...
He's had a problem with this guy for years.
Well, my initial problem...
The most recent guy? Or
yeah,
the, both
most, the most recent guy.
Okay.
My initial problem with Jake from State Farm was actually a bit misguided. My initial problem with him was that they had the first guy, then they dumped him for this like hot charismatic guy.
Yeah.
But as the story goes, the original Jake
hit
from State Farm
hit a little
Farm,
close to home. Did
say
it?
We're getting to the source of this.
The original Jake from State Farm actually was not interested in pursuing the lifestyle that current Jake from State Farm has.
He didn't want all the attention and fame.
Yeah,
is that
he
true?
Didn't want to be. Yeah, that is the because I believe he was an actual State Farm employee that they had tasked to do this commercial, and the commercial took off and went kind of viral. And he's like, I don't think I really want any. I don't want to be rich and famous.
What a terrible decision.
Yeah, I don't want to be rich and famous and like go courtside to every NBA game and stuff. Jake from State Farm popped up again last night. There was the WNBA draft. Caitlin Clark was drafted, and the first person that she saw after being drafted was not like one of her family members or her new coaches or teammates. She gave a big old hug to Jake from State Farm, who was waiting to envelop her in his arms. And then they did, like, they took a bunch of pictures together afterward. Like, they had a little photo shoot thing. It's just, I don't understand why Jake from State Farm is such a giant part of our culture. He is an insurance company mascot.
Why is Flo a big deal?
Exactly. That's my point.
Yeah,
I think these,
it's weird.
I think insurance mascots are taking up an outsized shine in our society. And I don't really understand why that is.
Although the trouble guy is amazing for Allstate.
Oh, yeah. Dennis Duffy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dean Winters.
Yeah, Dean is great.
I'm assuming she's probably going to do ads with State Farm. That's what that tells me.
For sure. Absolutely. But it's just weird that every time I try and watch any kind of like a sports thing, especially something involving any kind of basketball, I am assaulted by not a player or a coach or one of the brilliant reporters that cover the game, but Jake from State Farm. Mm. His big stupid damn mug is just staring me in the face every time I try to consume anything involving
meanwhile,
what I consider
the original
my
Jake's out there selling some schmuck a whole life policy.
I know, and he's like, "Are you Jake from State Farm?" And he's like,
"I was.
I gave it up." You think he's going to tell that story when he's old? Like, the one that got away.
He's like, and then I said, khakis?
I know, Grandpa.
I actually like that guy a lot better. He was just more interesting.
Yeah.
The first guy?
The guy that looked like Patton Oswalt.
Yes, he wasn't just like a generic, hot, charismatic guy that they...
He's coming back to the hot thing.
Well, they keep planting this dude at every single sporting event. I'm sick of looking at this guy.
This is sounding more like a personal problem.
I'm sick of looking at this guy.
It's like you're at that Christian men's festival. Welcome back, guys. DGS 236. Some storms moving into the area. Michael Calhoun will keep us updated on all of that. In the next break, we'll be talking to Ricky Horton, who knew Whitey very, very well, both on and off the field. Rach, why are people mad at Travis Kelce?
Well, he liked a post on Instagram that had Donald Trump in it.
Oh, there you go.
He liked a post that was done by a lady named Sage Steele, who used to be on ESPN, but she got fired in 2021 for making some comments on a podcast. But she went to some sort of sporting event, I think it was a fight, and met President Trump and shook his hand. And, you know, there was a picture taken of the moment. She put it up on Instagram, and Travis Kelce liked the post, mm-hmm. and people are just losing their minds that he liked the post, which, I mean, if you spend your time worrying about what other people are liking on social media, that is not a great way to live. It will stress you out. No, he hasn't said anything. He was just at Coachella this weekend, having a good time with Taylor Swift. They looked cute, but... what do you think, Wheels?
It's just hilarious because the other group of people were killing him over, you know, he's with Taylor Pfizer. Swift, so he must be a lib, and like it's just like you can't win.
Mm-hmm.
he's probably handling it best. Just ignore it.
Just
he's above it. None of it impacts him in any way.
Okay, let's say I met Donald Trump and I shook his hand and I put his picture up on Instagram. Would you guys like the post? Because if one of you guys did, I probably would. Politics aside, you're meeting a former president. It's kind of like a pretty cool Instagram post to put up. But people just have such hang-ups with Donald Trump.
I mean, I don't know. I don't understand how you like things. But I wouldn't be mad at you. I wouldn't be like, how dare you shake his hand?
Yeah.
He's a former president.
Mm-hmm.
I get it. One of 45, 46 guys.
Mm-hmm.
Just one of those things. People like to get mad about stuff. And Travis Kelce is definitely in the crosshairs right now, dating the most famous woman in the world. So he's being watched very closely.
Man, he's taking shots from both sides of it,
mm-hmm.
right? Because for a while there, it was a lot of the Swifties like, he's dangerous. Did you see him get mad at that coach? Oh, my God. And now they're probably mad at this. And then the other people are like, well, he's selling vaccines and he's with this liberal lady. Like, can we just stop? Can we settle down?
There's also, I just keep seeing videos of them from Coachella, and they're like in the crowd dancing, and it's very cute, but it's also really creepy that people are filming it because they're like cuddling and
it's having
just like a couple moment, and it's like, oh, I caught it on video. It's like, can they just live? Can they just dance a little bit without people documenting it?
Am I a jerk if I suggest that they're doing that in the crowd like that because they know they're going to get attention? Like, you can get a suite. You can... you don't have to be, like, just out there, do you?
Well, that's...
Maybe I don't know. Maybe I don't know the Coachella setup.
I think they're in, like, a celebrity-only section. Or, like, the VIP section. But it's still, like, anybody can spend the money and get into that section. But the videos where you see them dancing, Taylor's security is obviously, like... It's pretty awkward because he's standing right there staring at them with a straight face as they're dancing. It's kind of funny. But now people are kind of mad at Taylor Swift because they're saying, oh, wait, I thought she had to take a private jet because she just couldn't be in a crowd. She couldn't go through the airport like normal, but yet she can go to Coachella.
Uh-oh.
So, I mean, everybody just gets mad about everything.
Uh-oh, Taylor's in trouble too.
We all just hate everyone for everything, don't we?
It's always like, I caught you in a lie. I've caught you in something. It's like, I think they're just probably living their lives.
What's the thing about extra hours in the day?
Okay, this is really interesting. A small town in Norway wants to adopt a 26-hour day for people to spend more time with their family. Because people are always saying, oh, if only there were more hours in the day. This small town, the mayor is like, we're going to do it. Now, does she have a plan to make the day 26 hours? How is that going to work out math-wise?
Mm-hmm.
And she does not have a plan, but this is just an idea to just add an extra 2 hours to the day so you can spend more time with your kids.
So they will they will be like in a few years, they will be in the month of April and everybody else will be in June.
Exactly.
It is so funny to want to add 2 hours and then be like, now I don't know how.
Yeah.
But
it's a good idea. Like,
we're gonna fold
work.
Space and time.
Yeah.
Like, I saw a guy the other day on TikTok. Maybe you've seen him. He's one of these guys. You know, you're not doing enough push-ups.
And I'm a man.
And he was talking about, like, I get up at this time, I go to bed at this time, and he somehow gets 3 days.
Oh, he's such a liar.
Everyone, and I'm just like, oh, it sounds awful.
I've seen the hustle guys who claim, by if you only sleep 2 hours a night, then every week you get an extra day worth of time or whatever.
Oh,
and it's like, nah, I'm fine. I'll stay trying to sleep.
If I got 2 extra days, I'm just watching 2 more Ancient Aliens. Like,
yeah, exactly. Right. Like, I feel the same way. Like, I'm just, play more video games?
Yeah.
Like, I don't need the extra.
Phoebe lives away. Nick evidently has his own life now, so.
That's disgusting.
I know. He really abandoned me. He turned 29. He moves out. And suddenly I'm
Who
persona
could have
non
seen
grata.
This happening? This is messed up, man.
He said he'd never leave me.
Who else can we be mad at? For no good reason.
We can be mad at Elon Musk because he wants you to pay to post on X. He wants new users to pay a fee before they can post.
I tell you who I'm mad at. I'm mad at whoever on Drudge wrote the headline that says, Musk in a big mess. And I'm like, you know what? People who can't pay their rent are in a big mess.
Yeah, that's be more specific.
He could sell everything off. Let's say that he made the biggest bonehead moves of his life. And what's his absolute worst case scenario? If he 50 billion?
Yeah.
Let's say it's 10. Let's say this idiot goes from $300 billion to $10 billion. Yep. You're still one of the richest people in the world.
You're still in the top 1% of 1%.
No mess. Yeah. He has no mess.
It's still more than like everyone in the state of Missouri combined.
He's also like appears to be uncancelable because people have tried and he gets roasted on the daily online. Yeah. I mean, and it doesn't seem to bother him.
You
so
can't
it's like,
be canceled when you got that kind of money.
Right.
Yeah. Welcome back, guys. DGS. It's always great to talk to our buddy Ricky Horton. But on a day like today when we lost Whitey Herzog, it's really important, really meaningful. Rick, condolences. I know that he was a manager, a coach, a friend on and off the field.
Yeah, all those things to me, Dave, and thank you for that. You know, obviously enjoyed the Cardinal victory yesterday, but saddened to learn of the news of Whitey's passing today, and so good to me. And the way I describe him succinctly is he was a great manager of the game and a great leader of people. So he managed things, but he led people, and a great example for all of us.
And you know, Rick, having grown up a Cardinal fan and gone through the lean years of the 70s. And then you pick out an era. If you wanted to take a corkscrew and pull out one of the best eras, man, you lived through it. Those mid 80s, 82, 85, 87, the great lineups, the pitching, the position players. I mean, that was something.
It was very special. Of course, not the only decade of Cardinal greatness. You go back to the 40s and, of course, the 60s and beyond and 2000s. But I think the Whitey era was really special. It's special to, I think, a lot of people that live in St. Louis that are former players that are still connected to the Cardinals. And I think Whitey, I think that's kind of maybe a misreported or mistalked about thing, that what he did is he really asked us all to become part of the St. Louis community. There's more than 90 former players that still live in St. Louis. And I think he kind of got that ball rolling by saying, look, stay here, become a part of the community. That's what St. Louis is all about. And so he sold us on that. He sold the fans on his style of baseball, and he sold players to come out here and play for him, including Ozzie Smith. So, you know, he was a great salesman and a wonderful baseball guy, and certainly could manage a baseball game.
Yeah, Rick, I was talking to Wheels, and I were talking to Derek Gould earlier in the show and making the point that enormous charm, that huge personality, really sort of overshadowed what I don't think it's going over the top or getting over our skis to say that he had a real genius for the game.
Yeah, he really did. And you know, when people would talk about what was going on with the team in the 80s, he was the guy that would talk about it. I mean, it's not as if they would, you know, we would be at our locker and saying, here's what I think the team's doing. That was Whitey's job, and he was really good at that. And you know, he had the great stories. He would always manage in a way to win a ball game, but you know, the stories makes me think, Dave, of what he did post managing, where he'd come to our fantasy camps or anytime he's at the ballpark, he'd love to come to the games. He would be at the games a lot, watching the game. I don't mean just there for the fun of it. He would, you know, he's a down to earth guy, but yet he was baseball royalty. And Whitey would at the fantasy camps tell his stories. I have had more texts today from people that came to fantasy camps who are now friends of mine who were talking about just how important Whitey was at those special moments, sitting there having lunch down in Jupiter with one of the great baseball minds ever.
Ricky, it's funny you mentioned that. It was the first thing I thought of was 2013 and being down there with you guys.
Yeah.
And he's riding around the golf cart from field to field and, you know, encouraging people here and there. I know he made fun of me deservedly for a couple of things, but it's such an enjoyable thing just to know that that personality is there, and he's having fun. Like, he's there with a bunch of dorks like me, and he's just having a good time with baseball and talking to all you guys who are also having fun at our expense.
Well, one kind of behind-the-scenes thing is we'd always have him pick the best pitcher in camp, which I don't recall you coming up, Kevin. But the best player in camp. No, I'm just kidding. But we would have conversations, and I was stunned how serious he took that. I mean, he was saying, well, you know, this guy's got a really good, you know, he changes speeds well. And, you know, this is fantasy camp, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
We would have these conversations, and he really loved the game, and he loved the people there, Kevin. And you know, by being there, just what we're talking about. You know, he was probably the most you're afraid to approach him in a way. I think campers would be. But once you did, you asked yourself, why was I afraid to approach this guy? He is as likable and connecting as anybody that I know. And yet, again, superstar, Hall of Famer, but very down to earth.
So let's bring it back to the current era, 2024, and hopefully the era of Sonny Gray. Man, he couldn't be looking much better.
Yeah, yesterday was really good, a complete win. A lot of good things happened. And Sonny Gray, you know, hadn't walked a batter yet, and it seems like he hasn't thrown but three or four pitches out of where he exactly planned on throwing them. So, I mean, he's got great command. Fun to watch a pitcher. I noted with Brad Thompson after the game, we were on the bus talking about it. Neither one of us brought up or thought about or talked about velocity the entire game. We didn't care. I don't know what it was. It doesn't matter because he was in control of the game. He was pitching. He was sharp with everything. And really, it's a great way to start this series here in Oakland.
Rick, talk about how hard that is to do when you're coming off a very little time in spring training being able to pitch, right? I mean, he got shut down there for a bit, had to do a little bit in terms of, you know, like getting some live BPs and all that. But he decided, I don't necessarily want to waste bullets in the minor leagues. If I can help us win, I want to come up and win. And my God, he's been super sharp.
So the difficulty of that, Kevin, that's a great thought and great question and great idea to kind of beat around. It's almost like you haven't thrown a dart at a dartboard in 3 months and somebody says, hey, go ahead and hit that bullseye. And you know, without practice or without it. Or better yet, Dave, make this 8-foot putt. And I know you haven't played in 2 years, but this 8-foot putt, you can make it. And you're it's such a precision thing to pitch as it is to putt and to play darts. It's a fine-tuned, it's not just strength, it's not your cardio, I mean, it's all those things too, but it really is a precision movement with your fingers on a baseball, imparting spin just perfectly, and to not having had all that spring training work, it's marvelous what he's done.
Rick, you'll get this. I know it's piggish, but what Sonny Gray makes me want is another Sonny Gray. It really makes you miss, you know, I mean, there are teams that have two Sonny Grays, and it really makes you jealous. Yeah.
Well, I guess you just kind of watch a couple of games with the teams that have none of them, and maybe that'll make you feel better.
That's a great point.
Yeah, like the guys on the other side.
Yeah, but it is. But you're right, though. It does make you think about that. And you know, honestly, it's a long season, so who knows what might happen down the road.
How about Rick Nolan? He seems to be in the last handful of games starting to figure some things out, and his body language looked different.
He looks different.
Yeah, I heard you guys talking about that. I know. I mean, I know it's a common conversation, but I heard you guys talking about that, you and John, last night specifically. His body language is different than it was a week ago.
Yeah, he's a veteran player. He's done it a whole bunch of times, but he wears his heart on his sleeve, and when he's not right, you can see it. And he looks confident. He still has his waggle, and he's as antsy as anybody. It's like he's got bed bugs or something. He's moving all over the place. But he can kind of time all that up and hit line drives everywhere when he's right. And he's also hitting the ball the right field, too, which I think is key. So, you know, it's fun to watch him get back on track again. One thing I have to say quickly today, you know, also the passing of Carl Erskine, who I had the pleasure of knowing, longtime big league player, played for the Brooklyn Dodgers, played actually with Jackie Robinson.
Yeah.
And we, of course, honored Jackie yesterday. But the year after Jackie was a rookie in the big leagues, Carl Erskine said Jackie Robinson assimilated me as a big leaguer more than anybody did on my team. I'm grateful to have known Jackie Robinson. He should have been our manager. Carl told me that about 6 months ago, and it was just a pleasure to have a connection with him.
Did you know him well from when you were with the Dodgers?
I didn't, but we connected through a mutual friend. He had involvement with the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, Dodgers. He also was a Cardinal broadcaster for a bit with Jack Buck, and thought about doing that for a living until they said he'd have to move to St. Louis and was comfortable where he was in Indiana, but really just a wonderful man.
Very cool. Thank you, buddy. Have a great game.
All right. Thanks, guys.